Well, we come to the third of our series on John Calvin tonight, although I was worrying really all day that to deal with Calvin's abiding influence was more than a tall order in one lecture. It was impossible. But it occurred to me about 10 minutes ago, actually, and I was just thinking about next week, that the subjects we've put down, I'm not quite sure what the heading was, but it was sort of dealing with ethics. And we were looking at things like the Christian's attitude to war and the Christian and education. Forget what the other one was. But anyway, it's sort of ethics realm. But really, those are areas that we could have touched on today. Henry Meter's book, The Basic Ideas of Calvinism, was published about 20 years ago. That has long... It was republished about 20 years ago. I think it was first written during the Second World War. But that has long sections on the Calvinist attitude to war. So maybe we'll have more references to Calvin and his input when we carry on next week. But it does mean we can perhaps leave aside those particular aspects of Calvin's thought and influence, areas where he has had a lot of influence, and deal with them. You know, the course fits together. Well, if you got the study notes for this week, I hope you noticed the progression that the first week had a picture of Calvin when he was about 35, I think, and the second one when he was in his 40s, and as you'll see from this one, this was when he was about 153, I think. But actually, it's a Dutch one, Peter. You'd like to know this. It's a Dutch woodcut. And the books in the background, you can't perhaps see it very well in this time. It's copied and reduced. But they're supposed to be all his writings, his commentaries. And a great big thick one on the right and the shelf at the back is his commentary on the Pentateuch and so on. Right. We're going to look tonight at Calvin's legacy. Calvin and Calvinism, if you like, the abiding influence of this man on the world. It's very hard to measure such things, the more so in Calvin's case, I think, because Calvinism, as a sort of nickname, can be misleading. For one thing, it suggests that John Calvin invented the doctrines and the views and the ideas that he worked out in Geneva. It's often and rightly been pointed out that if there is such a thing as a Calvinist, then the Apostle Paul was a Calvinist, and Augustine in many ways was a Calvinist. Calvinism didn't begin with Calvin. It was biblical Christianity worked out to a very large extent. Then, of course, not everybody who's called a Calvinist and claims to be working out Calvinism is doing what John Calvin himself would have done. You can see this when you look at church history and the claims that are made. You know, some people claim that John Calvin's great contribution to human society was the principle of democracy, and one man, one vote stems from John Calvin. Calvinists have written books like that. On the other hand, you go to South Africa, you'll find some of the extreme Afrikaners there claiming that Calvin laid the basis for apartheid, which is anything but one man, one vote. So there's always that danger that people will foist things upon a great man like Calvin. Nonetheless, Calvin's legacy, that is, influence that can be traced directly to Calvin, and to the contributions that he made, his legacy is considerable. We need to get our map of Europe again that we had, or at least we had half of it on the first sheet, trying to show us where Calvin's life was lived. But it's not possible to go through all the countries that are mentioned there, but I've put them in sort of order. The first line of countries there, I think, are countries that were immediately, that is, during Calvin's lifetime, and lastingly, that is, right through till today, influenced by Calvin's teaching. There are more or less strong Calvinist churches in France and Scotland, the Netherlands, England and Hungary today. And yet these were all countries that were influenced during Calvin's lifetime. We saw last week how so many young men from France came to Geneva to train for the ministry. John Knox from Scotland came to Geneva and studied there, helped probably with the Genevan translation of the English Bible, and from Geneva went back to Scotland. You have there just below that list a letter of Calvin to Knox. The triumph of the Scottish Reformation was in 1560. This is Calvin writing, and I am delighted, as you can easily imagine, that the gospel has made such rapid and easy progress among you. That violent opposition should have been stirred up against you is nothing new, but the power of God is more clearly displayed in this, for no attacks either from Satan or from the ungodly have hitherto prevented you from advancing with triumph. Calvin thrilled at the Reformation in Scotland. But notice as a bit later on that Calvin isn't just reacting to Knox's news. He is advising. With regard to ceremonies, I trust that you will moderate your rigorous attitude, even if you cause displeasure to many. It is, of course, your duty to see that the church is purged of all the abuses which flow from error and superstition, but you are well aware that certain things should be tolerated as exceptions, even if you do not quite approve of them. One instance of that was the use of sponsors or godparents in baptism, a practice that had long been the norm in the Catholic Middle Ages, and which many people, and perhaps Knox himself, were inclined to immediately forbid. But Calvin advised him not to make an issue of it, so long as the parents themselves take the vows, and as well as the godparents, as long as the parents are clear on their duty. Calvin said to him in a letter, you must understand that the people have been steeped in this, and you can't expect to rid them of all their prejudices and superstitions and backgrounds overnight. After all, it's not the standing or falling of the gospel if there are godparents at baptism. That's the sort of thing. Calvin, you see, exerting an influence. He has taught at Geneva. Knox had, in a sense, studied there. Calvin has now reacted with showing his interest in the Reformation in Scotland. He's also advising. In England, Calvin had a considerable influence. Overleaf, there's a picture of Archbishop Cranmer, just for your edification. But Calvin was in correspondence with English reformers back in the days of Edward VI. He dedicated one of his commentaries to Edward VI. He was in correspondence with the nobles who were the Lord Protectors of England at that time. During the reign of Mary, 1553 onwards, when many English reformed people were in exile, many of them went to Frankfurt, above Strasbourg there, and they fell out among themselves over the use of the prayer book. Some, like Knox, the more radical reformers, wanted to have a form of service free of liturgy. Others wanted to keep to the Protestant prayer book of Edward VI. Calvin made one of his rare excursions from Geneva. He travelled all the way from Geneva to Frankfurt to try to bring peace to that divided English community. Again, a little token of how drastically, how thoroughly Calvin was concerned, not just for his own little church and his own country, but for all the countries that he had contact with. In Hungary, which then was a vast country, over on the faced with the threat of the Muslim Turkish invasions, Calvinism had a tremendous impact. There was a time when a large part of Hungary was reformed. It was later on to Hungary that the Jesuits came as bitter opponents of the Reformation. But the leaders, especially from Transylvania, came to Geneva and studied and took back their Calvinist faith to Hungary. Hungary was then, as it still has, as we were hearing the other week, a considerable reformed church. And the Netherlands, and we mustn't leave them out, they were one of the earliest countries in Europe to be thoroughly influenced by Calvinism. Strangely enough, initially the main centre of Calvinism was in what was then known as the, well, what you would then call the southern Netherlands, really what is now Belgium. And it was only later that Calvinism spread to the north. I think probably, perhaps Peter would say on this, but I mean, it was probably more when they had the war of independence against the Spanish, it was easier for the north to hold out against the Spanish with the sort of dikes and the islands and so on. It was more easily defended, whereas the south was quickly overrun, wasn't it? And there were great massacres in Antwerp and places like that through the 1550s and 60s and so on. Is that fair? Yeah. And so, yes, there was a, yes, and it sort of changed over the what we know of as the Belgic Confession, which is the confession of faith of the Dutch churches, was written by a man who lived in Breda. Was he from Breda? Or was he from Mons? Flemish, yes, it was down there somewhere. Anyway, Holland was sustained by Calvinism in its great war of independence against the Spaniards that ran on for decades through the second half of the 16th century. And from that day to this has been a stronghold of Calvinism. France, well, we looked at last week the triumph and the tragedy of the Reformed Church in France, one of the great strongholds of the Reformed faith through the 16th and into the 17th century. But in the tragedy of the French Civil Wars, French Calvinism was eventually snuffed out. It's fascinating, if you want to go into the sort of historic or sociological reasons for that. In France, Calvinism was perhaps seized upon or used by the nobles who were in dispute with the central authority. Whereas in Scotland, though the nobles helped Calvinism initially, it was a movement that had its own resources and its own strength, independent of the nobles. For all sorts of social, historical, economic reasons, the nobles in France were a sort of doomed class, like the old barons in medieval England. And it's fascinating to trace, the complicated interaction of religious movements and political and social change. But for whatever reason, and because of bitter and fierce persecution over some 150 years, the Huguenots were just about snuffed out in France. Although, of course, Huguenot exiles fled to the Netherlands, to England, had a large community here in London, and also Huguenots were in the forefront of the colonization of America and of other colonies. So while French Calvinism only survived in the very weakest form in France, it did have a great influence in other countries. In the second line, you have countries where Calvinism made some temporary or secondary influence. Maybe these are lesser known. In Germany, especially in the area known as the Palatinate, down the Rhine, centered on Heidelberg, Calvinism became the religion of the principality and of that area. And there are other parts of Germany where Calvinism, rather than Lutheranism, became the official religion of the area. It was from the German Calvinists that the great Heidelberg Catechism came, which remains, in my opinion, the best of all the great Reformed catechisms. German Calvinists suffered terribly in the 30 Years' War of the 17th century because where the Lutherans and the Catholics had fought before and reached a sort of mutual respect and toleration for each other within severe limits, the Calvinists were excluded from that. And the 30 Years' War did greatly cause havoc in the Calvinist communities, not only in Germany, but in Bohemia. Indeed, it was the Calvinists of Bohemia who were the cause of the outbreak of the 30-year war in 1618. But there in Bohemia, of course, there'd been Jan Hus in the 15th century, and the Brethren, the Moravian Brethren, not Moravian, the Bohemian Brethren, the Hussites. And when Calvinism came to Bohemia and through into Poland, many of the Hussites joined with the Calvinists. In Poland, give another instance, there was considerable growth of Calvinism, especially around Krakow in, I think it's called Little Poland. And there was a union between the Hussite church, which had gone into exile from Bohemia because of persecution, and these Calvinist churches. The rulers of Poland for a while were very sympathetic to Calvinism. John Calvin was even invited to go to Poland and help them organize the churches there. Some of you may have been here long enough to remember that some years ago we did a study on John Alasco, who founded the first Reformed church here in London, a church of exiles. But Alasco was himself a Pole, and he went back to Poland. And there for about 100 years, there was a fairly strong Calvinist church. Same goes for Lithuania. I came across a long article in an old Princeton Review this week, The Ancient Calvinist Churches of Lithuania. I don't suppose a lot of you knew about them, but you know, there were these churches around. Calvinistic influence spread through many countries, and we're not really mentioning here Italy and Spain, where a church never really was able to get off the ground because of the severity of persecution, but where nonetheless there were a considerable number of Calvinistic martyrs and secret Calvinists. A man called Peter Martyr, who eventually fled to Switzerland and to England and had a big role in the English Reformation. He was an Italian who had been converted and had been greatly influenced by Calvin. One other interesting point there, even the Ottoman Empire was not impervious to Calvinism. A man called Cyril Luca was the Patriarch of Constantinople in the Greek Orthodox Church in the early 1700s. He had studied in Switzerland, and there's good evidence from his writings to believe that the man was an evangelical believer, a Calvinist. And he tried to bring in some gradual and subtle reforms in the Greek Orthodox Church. There was all sorts of intrigues. The Jesuits were intriguing there as well. And probably at the instigation of the Jesuits, Cyril Luca was eventually assassinated. He was arrested by the authorities, and he was strangled in his prison cell. But Calvinism reached through all the countries of Europe, more or less. Well, then, of course, you've got these other slightly later in the American colonies. Of course, it wasn't all that much later. There was almost a total Calvinistic influence in the founding of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. The Puritans who went to Boston, the Pilgrim Fathers, the Separatists who went to Plymouth a bit earlier, they were Calvinists, at least in their doctrine of salvation. But the men who went to Boston and founded the much more important Massachusetts colony, they were Calvinists, they were Puritans. In the other colonies too, South Carolina had a large number of Huguenots, German Calvinists from the Palatinate, Scots and Scots-Irish, and so on. Calvinists through and through. Later on, God's providence, Canada, Australia were colonized and were greatly influenced, especially by the immigration of the Ulster Irish, that is the Presbyterian Irish, and the Scottish emigrants. And Presbyterianism, Calvinism, became a major force in all those countries. South Africa, of course, had not only a lot of Scottish and Irish immigrants, but also a large number of Dutch immigrants, and the Dutch Reformed churches have their branches in South, or their sort of sister churches in South Africa today.
Then on the last line, we remind you of the worldwide continuing impact. In Indonesia, there's a large daughter church of the Dutch Reformed Churches. Korea is one of the quickest growing areas of Christian churches in the world today, and yet the church, the evangelization of Korea in the last 100 years was almost entirely carried out by Calvinistic Presbyterians from America and some from Australia too. In Japan, there's a growing Reformed church. In South America too, in Brazil especially, there's quite a lot of Presbyterian work. And in Peru, of course, we mustn't forget the influence of Calvinism there. In many parts of Africa, there are churches that have been influenced by Calvinism, Calvinistic missions. And in Egypt, I'm thinking of there's a Presbyterian church in Egypt that's been there for at least 100 years. The Irish Reformed Presbyterians had missions in Egypt and in Beirut in the Lebanon and Syria, and there is quite a thriving Presbyterian church in Egypt today. Or tracing a legacy from John Calvin. Okay, well, that's just to sort of open your eyes a little bit. You know, I think it's good to do that as well, because while Calvinism is of varying strengths in those countries, we tend to suffer from a sort of either a remnant feeling or a sort of an oddity feeling that we're peculiar, we're an odd little bunch. We need to look at this history and see that how widely throughout the world Calvinistic churches have spread far more widely and effectively than Anglican churches, for instance. The Anglicans can have their, you know, Lambeth Conference of Bishops, but when Calvinists get together, and there have been this century a number of international Calvinistic conferences, we can draw people from a much wider and fuller area, not just the parts of the world that had the blessings of the British Empire, which is really where Anglicanism has grown, but from places like Korea, Japan, and so on, which have never been colonized by England. Well, in many of those early instances, it was through writings, you know, in the European ones, in the days of the Reformation, through writing and through the individuals who went to study in these places. You know, often you'd get someone like Knox, I suppose, you know, who would was converted and had some experience. Then, in exile from Scotland, he writes books and sends them back to Scotland. And then he goes back to Scotland, and they're the leadership of, in many, many places, the leadership of the emerging Protestant churches was provided by men who had trained at Geneva. And that gave it a sort of definite emphasis and character. Later on, of course, it to these colonies, it was by emigration or by missionary work and so on. Yeah. Okay, well, why was it that there was this continuing impact? That's really when we come over to the second side of the back of the first sheet. Why was it that Calvinism had this impact? Why did Calvinism have a far wider impact than, say, Lutheranism? Lutheranism spread in mainly, or one would say almost exclusively, in German-speaking areas, in Germany itself, and up into Scandinavia, not actually German-speaking, but closely akin to it, and into areas like what we'd know of as Latvia and Estonia, where there's a strong German population. Lutheranism was very German. It's interesting that the Poles, in as far as they became Calvinistic, largely they became Calvinistic because they didn't like anything German. Then, you know, as still, Poland and Germany were natural enemies. And Lutheranism was so German, Calvinism was much more palatable to those people. But even in German Switzerland and parts of Germany, Lutheranism had didn't really take on. And in other countries, France and Britain and so on, and Holland, Lutheranism really made no lasting impact at all. Why did Calvin's teaching make that impact? Well, in a way, there's a very easy answer to that. And it is that Calvin's teaching was more thoroughly biblical than Luther's. That's not to disparage Luther. Luther had, grasped the great biblical doctrine of justification by faith, the very heart of the gospel. But Calvin put things in their place. I think if you look at that quote on the right, on the second sheet there, the second half there, in the middle, in studying the Calvinistic religion, one is immediately impressed by the proper balance in the emphasis placed upon the several doctrines which the Calvinist believes. And it goes on to say, look, other denominations, other sorts of Christianity, very often have one doctrine that they're very good on and make a great emphasis on, but they tend to neglect others, and you have, a rather lopsided sort of Christianity. In Calvinism, and Demeter here is arguing, because Calvin has the centre of his teaching, the sovereignty of God, all the other doctrines are in their right place. And what you have is a balanced, a full-blooded form of Christianity. Calvinism is more thoroughly biblical than Luther. Lutheranism. Dear me. Would you excuse me? Rang off. Right. So, the simple answer is that Calvinism, being more thoroughly biblical, has that greater impact of a more biblical Christianity. But we can break that down into detail, and as Mieters already implied in that quote we've looked at, Calvinism's impact is because of its God-centeredness. Calvinism produced sturdy Christians. Calvin's influence, Calvin's teaching, produced Christians with real backbone. And you can read any number of books on it, or even better, read the writings not only of Calvin but of Calvinists then and down through the ages, and you will find that they are God-centered people. Calvin's Institutes begins with that famous quotation that all our wisdom, insofar as it is held to be true and perfect, consists of two things, namely a right knowledge of God and of ourselves. In that second quote, you see, he talks about piety, which is, if you like, religion. The pious mind deems it right and meet to observe God's authority, reverence his majesty, take care to advance his glory and obey his commandments. He is in fear of God, and yet, a bit further down, it is not so terrified by the awareness of his judgment as to wish to run away, even if some way of escape were open. Here is someone who fears God, and yet who stands before God, because he knows it loves, this mind loves and reveres God as Father, worships and adores him as Lord. This isn't a man-centered religion. Calvin would never use as his a badge or a leaflet that said, God loves you and has got a wonderful plan for your life. Or smile, Jesus loves you. Calvin would point men to God. And his great concern is not to look at you and your life and how happy you could be, but to bring men to stand before God. The awe, the reverence, the love of God, the obedience of God to God. Those are the very center of Calvinism. And of course, that finds expression in his that doctrine for which he is most famous or notorious, the doctrine of predestination. It's wrong to say that predestination is what Calvinism is all about. It's not predestination which is central, but the majesty and the sovereignty of God. And of course, that implies predestination, that follows on from that, as does also Calvin's doctrine of providence. The firm conviction that God is immediately in control of everything that happens. I have an instance there at the bottom of page 2. Persecution, says Calvin, is a special mark of God's favour. To suffer persecution for righteousness' sake is a singular comfort, for it ought to occur to us how much honour God bestows upon us with the special badge of his soldiers. Maybe if you were here last night when we were looking at the three men in the burning fiery furnace, there you see how Calvin is reflecting that truth of Daniel chapter 3. How much honour God bestowed upon those three young men. God used them to display his glory. God used them in the advance of his kingdom. And only when you are God-centred, only when the glory of God is center stage, rather than your own happiness or your own immediate comfort, can you begin to think in those terms. I think Mita puts it well at the top there. If there is one Christian who stresses belief in God, it is the Calvinist. His first and last thought everywhere is God. This is the golden thread that colours the whole of Calvinistic theology. Everything depends upon God. Religion, although it blesses man, exists not for man, but in the last analysis, for God. And it is that God-centeredness worked out in Calvin that is at the very heart of his teaching. A faith with backbone that produced Christians with backbone, people who had that belief in the sovereignty of God, the predestination of God, the providence of God. It's no coincidence that they were the people who stood in France, the Huguenots, through all the terrible sufferings there, galley slaves and so on. In Scotland, the Covenanters. In England, the Puritans. And so on. These people had the firmness to endure persecution without being driven to fanaticism, as other groups were, but with a firm and a manly and a bold confidence in God. Calvin's doctrine of God enabled people to stand in persecution. It also means being biblical, and of course we're saying all this under the heading that Calvin is biblical, having a God-centered Christianity means that it is always relevant because God is unchanging. If you center on some particular man view of the world and man's needs, those do change. You know, medieval monasticism was a man-centered religion, and it was in many ways developed in response to the social conditions and pressures of medieval Europe emerging from the Dark Ages. But that sort of medievalism, monasticism, was doomed when the Renaissance came and the arrival of the nation-state and so on, because it was really an expression of medieval society in Christian form. Whereas Calvinism, by centering upon God, means that in every age that can be worked out afresh and not lose its relevance. Let's quickly mention another thing. I didn't find any extract. Well, I did find an extract, but I couldn't copy it. Calvin's teaching on the Holy Spirit and effectual calling, this was really what I was saying yesterday morning when we looked at the Confession of Faith, that last section of chapter 8, is it, of the Confession on Christ the Mediator, which stresses that Christ not only purchased redemption for us, but that Christ powerfully and sovereignly brings redemption to us. He didn't, in that sense, finish when he had accomplished redemption on the cross. But he works by his Spirit to persuade and enable us to embrace the gospel. He effectually calls us. Here was especially where Lutheranism broke down. Luther initially really was a Calvinist, if that's not an anachronistic term. But Luther wavered in some of his views, and you may know that later on after Luther's death there was a great controversy in Lutheranism, and Melanchthon, Luther's one of his main successors, really changed his opinion and watered down his belief in the sovereignty of God in the application of redemption. He really gave man a role, man's free will a role in bringing about his own salvation. Calvin avoided that error, and Calvin's teaching of the sovereignty of God in salvation again gives it gives powerful motivation to preach the word. You see, if you do like Lutheranism more than half does, and give some sort of magical power to the sacraments or to man's free will, then it puts pressure on preaching the word. It tends to derogate from the faithful, persevering preaching of the word, whether men will hear or not. Calvinism says, preach the word, be instant in season or out of season, because God does have his elect, and God will use the foolishness of preaching to bring his elect to salvation. You may be confident in that. And of course, because it puts all the emphasis on God's sovereignty in conversion, it drives men to pray, to be prayerfully dependent upon God. I don't mean when I say all the emphasis on God's sovereignty that it doesn't call men to believe. Indeed, it does. And it challenges and commands men to believe. But recognizing God's sovereignty produces a sense of dependence and prayerfulness. So Calvin's, if you like, his pure doctrine of God and God's sovereignty, right through to sovereignty in conversion, gave a sharpness, a solidity, a relevance, a power to Calvin's teaching wherever it was found. But the way that doctrine was worked out in practice also has a lot to do with Calvin's success. The church, in its Calvinistic form, if you like, in its Presbyterian or Reformed form of order, that is, organization and discipline, is another key reason why Calvinism made such an enduring impact. The stress of Calvin on an educated ministry. Even in, say, France, when there was fierce persecution, the Reformed churches under Calvin's influence sent their young men to study for years at Geneva. If a man is to preach, especially to a hunted, persecuted underground church, he must be thoroughly learned in the scriptures. He must have a command of the scriptures, preferably in their original languages, so that he can faithfully expound the word of God. Calvinism always stressed that. In the covenanting period in Scotland, young men were sent across to Holland to train for the ministry. James Rennick, who was the last martyr of the covenanting period in 1688. He was not long back from studying in Antwerp, I think. Because, you know, they didn't say, well, look, in these days of persecution, we'll just be glad whoever can preach, God will provide. No, they said, we must have an educated ministry to faithfully and thoroughly expound the word. That emphasis within church order has a lot to do with Calvinism's continuance. Then, too, the fact that the church, Calvinistic church, with its local elders and pastor, it has a sort of cell-like structure that can survive persecution. You know, there are some churches, Episcopal churches, which can't survive unless there's a bishop to ordain the priests, and unless someone can come around with the holy water, or somebody can consecrate the elements. But Calvinism, with its stress upon the eldership from the local community, can survive. And Presbyterianism was always very adept at forming little societies, little praying groups, even where they were just a small and persecuted remnant. Along with that, of course, you didn't get totally isolated groups. These groups instinctively kept in touch with each other. They corresponded with each other. And even in times of persecution, they met together to discuss and to maintain cohesion. See, the danger is if you're too centralized, if you're completely dependent upon one man, the bishop, or one central authority, severe persecution can cut the head off the church. And the church has lost its head if those few people are arrested. On the other hand, if you have no cohesion at all, if you're completely independent, then the danger is that in persecution, you're going to be at the mercy of strange doctrines, and people, groups are going to go off at a tangent. That happened with the Anabaptists to a large extent. But by and large, the Presbyterians held together. The covenanting period in Scotland is a good instance of that. Although there were those fringe groups that went very extreme, by and large, the main body of covenanters held together remarkably well. And when deliverance came in 1688, were able to resume the national life of the church. Presbyterianism, I think, also, or Calvinism, also makes that abiding impact, because it does stress, to use a bad word, the laity. That it isn't a clerical religion. While it stresses the importance of a thoroughly trained ministry, it teaches every Christian to be an intelligent believer. And it encourages the development of gifts within the local congregation, the elder, the deacon, and so on. It mobilizes people. Presbyterian or Calvinist churches always had a high level of commitment and education, well, theological education, among their people. It is a religion that doesn't just sort of prop people up against a priest so that they say, you know, like the Irishman, I believe what the priest believes. And Calvinism produces people who know what they believe. This sort of church order had a lot to do with the spread of Calvinism. The family and education was another good reason why. In that quote on the sheet, did you notice there that, yes, that was the other point I should have said. Not only did it have this order, but it also had discipline. Sometimes a very stern discipline, but an effective one. And that had not a little to do with its spread and its success. It's interesting there to contrast Germany, Lutheranism, with Scotland and its Calvinism. In Germany, Lutheranism very much came under the thumb of the nobles. And you had the famous scandal of Philip of Hesse, who had a bigamous marriage, and the Lutheran church sort of kowtowed to him and made an exception and said, well, in his case, it's all right. Whereas in Edinburgh, when Knox and the Protestants had become the dominant church, very soon after 1560, you found the Kirk Session of Edinburgh summoning the leading noble of Scotland and having him up before the session for immoral life and publicly rebuking him in the church, commanding him to sit on the stool of repentance and so on. Now, whatever you might think about the sternness of that discipline, that made a tremendous impact on the ordinary people. The thoroughness of Calvinistic discipline. It also, of course, stressed the need for their religion to be more than just an outward form. So many people at the Reformation exchanged a superficial Roman religion for a superficial Protestant religion. But Calvinism, with its stress on personal discipline and morality, sought to see that the truth was driven deeper home than that. That goes too for marriage. The family, they're just for interest. You can read those little extracts from Geneva and the marriage laws. Calvinism is a religion of the whole life. Because God is central to it, then everything in our lives comes under God's sway. And perhaps the most obvious continuing symptom of Calvinism, if that's the right word, is the stress on family life and family religion. The picture of the Puritan home, with the father, a sort of prophet to the household, leading family worship, and the children being catechized in the faith. That's Calvinism. And it is that emphasis on the teaching of the young and the raising of the children of the covenant within a biblical Christian family home with discipline and example and instruction. It's that that has given Calvinism its enduring and abiding impact. That, of course, is sometimes the cause of much attack on Calvinism. There's an interesting quote there on the left from the historian James Froude last century, that discussing the charge that Scottish life has been gloomy and austere, he points to the fact that the Scots are noted for kindly, genial humour, which half loves what it laughs at. And then he goes on to say, I don't know what you make of this, we could have a vote on it, couldn't we? I should rather say that the Scots have been an unusually happy people. What do you think, Donald? Good. How about the non-Scots? Would the Scots kindly leave the room while the rest of us have a vote on this? It's an interesting one, that, isn't it? Because people talk about the Celtic races with their sort of emotional and sort of rather gloomy view of life. Andrew's taking his glasses off in the back. But I'm not sure. I think, you know, when you look at Calvinism, wherever it's found, I think it produces the same sort of serious, but in a real sense, happy and contented life. I think, you know, you find it in Holland, you find it, I know, some Spanish Reformed people. I think you find it in America, people from all different backgrounds there. What I think may be a factor there is that if there are such things as national characteristics, they maybe tend to accentuate the influence of Calvinism. And maybe when the religious, biblical, spiritual influence ceases to be the immediate, fresh, powerful thing, then national characteristics can tend to take over. And I think you could argue a strong case for that in certain parts of the Highlands, for instance. You could say, well, no, Calvinism in biblical form molded the Highland way of life very much. But when Calvinism has become a tradition rather than a living, conscious reality, then maybe what we see in some parts of the Highland is a Calvinism that's been distorted into a sort of rather gloomy, legalistic sort of life. And maybe that's happened there because of largely because of the characteristics that in the people and other factors, you know, the history and problems there. I think you could argue in those sort of lines. Obviously, it's not possible to isolate and say, well, this is purely due to biblical influence. And also, things like national characteristics are so difficult to pin down, aren't they? You know, I mean, if you say the... And it's so hard to measure. I mean, I feel that people say that the Scots have got no sense of humour. But, I mean, I knew my people in Ardnamurchan, and it struck me that very often the things that I thought were funny, they didn't think were funny at all. But other things they thought were hilarious. That I, you know, sense of humour is such a localised thing, isn't it? That somebody comes along and says, well, these are miserable people, and yet what he's really saying is they don't think funny, you know, they don't enjoy what I enjoy. But at its best, in essence, Calvinism has had this great impact. The other thing that I think has added to its effect is particularly the matter of education. We'll just mention that quote on the right is at the bottom there. It's very interesting that in Geneva, education was provided for all, including the poorest, and it was compulsory for all. And it's very interesting to, if any of you have done education, history of education in this country, very interesting to trace the difference between the Scottish education in the past, which was largely influenced by Calvinism, and the English education system, which was much more riddled with English class consciousness and so on. But Calvinistic emphasis on popular education, Calvinistic the democracy of education, so that the lad of parts could progress from the poorest home and become Lord Chancellor or whatever. That's something that Calvinism has brought about with great stress. Well, there's a few other things on the back. I won't turn to those now. All the problems of Calvinism perhaps need to be looked at. Slavery, apartheid, and so on. Calvinists, as McNeill shows on the right, did staunchly defend slavery and the superiority of one race over another in America at the time of the Civil War. Although, the more you read of those things, the more you realize that perhaps we're the last ones to make judgments on people, because men who lived in the situation are often there. But you do, mind you, Calvinists can be prejudiced. There was a lovely, Diane might appreciate this. I was reading the life of Benjamin Morgan Palmer, who was a great Southern Presbyterian minister. And he was brought up in South Carolina. And his biographer was writing about South Carolina and what a marvelous form of civilization it was. And he said, in the city of Charleston, he said, there was no prejudice. It was a city free of prejudice, largely because, and this was largely because its inhabitants came from the finer races. They were English and Scottish and Scots-Irish and French Huguenots. And, I thought it was a gloriously prejudiced statement. You know, there was no prejudice because they all came from the superior races. But it's easy to see other people's prejudices, isn't it, and other people's blind spots. Calvinism tends to be in the battlegrounds of the world. And, on something like apartheid, I think they're grossly distorting not so much even Calvin's teaching, but some of the teaching of men like Abraham Kuyper and so on. And it's interesting that I think even the Dutch Reformed churches in South Africa are moving away from their support of apartheid. Just last things, the time's really gone. Sorry, I knew it was too much tonight. The bottom right-hand side, I think that's a very famous extract from Warfield. He says, Calvinism is theism come to its rights. Theism, that is, the belief in a living and an active and a controlling God, as opposed to deism, which believes in one God, but who has sort of left the world to get on with itself. Calvinism is theism in its highest form. Warfield says in that booklet that ultimately, he says, there are only two forces in the world, atheism and theism. But Calvinism is pure theism. You know, and it says, look, either there is a God, who is God, who is sovereign over creation, over providence, over salvation, or there is no God at all. And you know, his argument is that ultimately the battle in the world is between Calvinism and atheism. Calvinism is religion at the height of its conception. What is religion but the worship and service of God? Calvinism is religion at its highest point. And Calvinism is evangelicalism in its purest and most stable expression. It is saving Christianity in its clearest form, purest form, and its most stable form. It's interesting that when people have departed from Calvinism, men like John Wesley, who felt that he could preach the gospel more effectively by denying Calvinism, he couldn't produce a stable form of Christianity. And all these weird and wonderful groups, and some not so wonderful, that we have today, right through the modern charismatic movement, they can, in a very real sense, all be traced to John Wesley. John Wesley rejected Calvinism, but he couldn't produce a stable alternative. So many evangelicals reject Calvinism. Usually what they reject is a misunderstanding of Calvinism. And yet, insofar as they're evangelical, they're Calvinist. You know the old saying that the greatest Arminian is a Calvinist on his knees. You know, why pray for anybody to be converted unless God can bring them to conversion? And our Christian friends who might be appalled at the thought of Calvinism, they are Calvinists on their knees because they pray as if God were totally in control, and he is. Well, I don't know if you've got any questions or thoughts on that. Maybe we can sort of co-opt these next 3 weeks and on this sort of area of practical applications of Calvinism, because I'd meant to give you more time for questions tonight. But do you have any particular questions or comments there? This is a book called The History and Character of Calvinism by John T. McNeill. He's interesting. He's a bit liberal and ecumenical in some ways, but it remains a very, very good story. It begins with Calvin's life. He tells the story of the spread of Calvinism, and he has some chapters at the end on the implications of it. He was brought up in Prince Edward Island. If you're all avid readers of Anne of Green Gables, he was from that community there, which was sort of Scots Presbyterian stock. And of course, it was he that edited the biggest edition of Calvin's Institutes that was republished some years ago. Well, why don't you look through those, and then next week when we look at ethics and morals, we'll begin next week with some time to discuss these. I'd like to get you talking on Calvinism and slavery, or Calvinism and apartheid. Does Calvinism make us miserable, and so on, and gloomy? Paul thinks it does. But perhaps we'll spend some time on that next week. It's too much to try and deal with. If Warfield's right, then we were rather optimistic to deal with Calvinism. If it's theism, religion, and evangelicalism in its highest form, it was a bit much to try and deal with it in 50 minutes. But thanks anyway.